Succession number 10413, Rule 12.
Mr. George South, Reel 12. You were running the officers' mess at Mighty Camp then, and you'd had enough. How did you come to get your next posting?
Well, I went and saw the camp commandant and told him that I was sick of this job as in the officers' mess. And he said he would replace us, or try to get a replacement. And until I got one, he would put me in the sergeant's mess, see if I was any happier in there. And so I left the officer's mess and went into the sergeant's mess. And the sergeant in charge of the sergeant's mess took my job in the officer's mess.
Did you prefer it there?
And no, I still had this feeling that I wanted to be away. And I had this job for about 3 weeks, and then I was posted back to GHQ Cairo, where I was placed in the quartermaster's group, of which Lieutenant Colonel Daddy Lowe of the Durham Light Infantry was the boss. And so I was attached to a colour sergeant out of the tank corps, who was hoping to go home to Blighty any time. And so I was supposed to learn his job. And so I went out with this colour sergeant and wasn't very happy because I found out he was fiddling.
How was he fiddling? What method was he using?
Well, the way I found it out was that one day we had to take a 3-ton lorry full of blankets to the RSD, Return Stores Depot. And we drove up with the chit to the entrance of this depot. Showed it to the bloke on the gate. You want to be at shed so-and-so. So I went to this shed, went in, showed the quartermaster in charge of this shed that we had 160, I think it was, 160 blankets on the wagon. And he signed it, that he'd received them, told them where to dump them, and we just drove out the depot, showed the man on the gate that we'd delivered 160 blankets, and he dropped me off in a cafe. Called back for me about 3/4 of an hour later with empty wagon. Asked him where the blanket was and never you mind. And gave us a handful of piastres. And another day took some pumps, water pumps. And the same thing happened. And so I asked Harry Lowe if I couldn't have a job in the office. Because I could see what this man was doing. He was making a bit of bob or two before he came back to England.
Why did you disapprove so much? Do you think you get implicated, or what was it?
I'm not going to say that honesty is the best policy, because I could do all the thieving I wanted to do. But on a scale like that, I suppose at the bottom of me, you get a run, but you always get caught. And I wasn't prepared to get caught. And I've always said this many times. If I was going to break the law, think, are you going to be prepared to take the punishment? If you're not going to be prepared, don't break the law. And I live by that rule, still to this day. And so I knocked about the office, running errands and one thing and another. And Harry asked me once why I'd rather be in the office than out on the road with my friend. And I just passed it off, that too much humping. I was still a fragile man. And then the Battle of Alamein started. And old Harry sent for me and asked me if I would like to go up the desert with a VIP officer's mess. And I asked him what this entailed. And I had 10 small tents for officers, 2 marquees, all the cutlery and china in the world, pots, pans, a cook, 2 waiters, and myself, and a driver, 3-ton lorry. And I was to report to Montgomery's rear echelon. Put this officer's mess up for visiting VIPs. Would I like to go? And I said yes. I'll probably bump into the lads. And so we reported to the rear echelon. And by that time, the ball was beginning to roll up the desert. So I was told not to unpack the lorry, make ourselves useful. And eventually we were sent to Monty's HQ, where we used to put these marquees up and the tents up. And eventually Monty and his staff started coming into our officer's mess. And I got on famous with them, excepting for one man, one officer, who was a major, and he was in the QM department of Monty's HQ. And
is this how you came to leave them?
Mm-hmm. Well, first, I haven't got that far yet. Yeah.
First, what did you think of... Now, this is where you did get a chance to know Montgomery, mm-hmm. and some of the other quite well-known personalities. Mm-hmm. Can you go through a few of them and say what you thought of them, or, and any stories you might have about them?
Well, I met Alexandra, who was a very nice man, I thought, very quiet, unless somebody roused him and he could be...
Did you see that happen?
Later on, I did. But at that particular time, Monty, I spoke with Monty many times.
What did you think of him?
I thought he was very well. He's very sharp. at times. Not that he was ever sharp to me or the staff, but to the brother officers, he could lay the law down in no mean uncertain terms. One man I did like, who very seldom, I think I've only heard his name mentioned once since the war, was a Channel Islander. And he was in charge of the planning office. A Major General De Gingand. You'll probably have heard him down there. But I've never, very seldom, heard this man.
What was so nice about him?
Well, he treated you as a fellow man and not as other rank. You know, a servant, which a lot of them did. Quite a lot of them used to look down upon you, you know, like children should be seen and not heard, you know, they give you that impression. But this major, I mean, him had quite a few battles. I used to have many little battles with him, nothing serious.
What was the cause of the friction between you?
Because he wanted to take over my stores and on specific orders from GHQ Cairo and through Lieutenant Colonel, on no account was I to hand any of these stores to any other unit. And so I used to stand by that. And this is what caused a lot of friction.
What were these VIP officers' behaviour and drinking habits like?
Up in the desert, they got very little drink. We didn't carry any drink. They only drank what they brought with them. You used to get an issue every week, you know, a couple of bottles of beer and a few cigarettes and that. And we had cigarettes for the officers' mess. We got allowance, the officers' mess. We got allowance of whiskey and gin. But if there was a lot in the mess, they could suck the lot in about half an hour, and that was it. So they didn't get a lot of drink. And I went through the desert, along with Monty's HQ, many a time within a stone's throw of the battalion. And when Benghazi fell, we were taken to a camp at Benita, which was an aerodrome outside of Benghazi. And I had to come into Benghazi one day for some rations, looking for fresh fruit and fresh vegetables. And as I came out down the hill from Benita, here's the 8th Battalion, the Durham Light Infantry, camping on the side of the road. So I stopped there, went round, and to my great surprise, there wasn't many of the old boys left. And everywhere I went, I was asked, when the hell are you coming back to the battalion? And so I went into Benghazi, bought a few veg and what was there, went back to Benita, and straight away asked for a medical board. And about 3 days later, I was told to go to this field ambulance where I would receive a medical board. And I went in front of a brigadier and two colonels. And requested that I be upgraded back to A1 so that I could rejoin my unit. And they examined me and told me to go outside, wait, and they would give me my verdict. And the sergeant came out. Boy, oh boy. You're for the high jump. And so I went back in. And I was threatened with a court-martial if I ever wasted a medical board's time again. And so...
Why? Because she was still so bad?
There was no way could I become a fighting soldier again. So I went back to my officer's mess, and resigned myself to the fact that I would never see the battalion, never go back to the battalion, and just carried on.
Well, you were in close contact with all these fairly famous people. They're famous now, not so famous then, some of them. Were you aware of any of frictions or anything going on between them at the time, or were any of them especially friendly to each other? Or
you used to hear them. I wouldn't say a friction. A different point of view of how things should be done. I wouldn't say friction, though. I've seen officers telling other officers off in no uncertain words. And the next time they come in the mess, they've been drinking together. So I couldn't say that I ever saw anybody that really, you know, down to earth fallout.
So they had professional disagreements, but not personal?
Not personal. I mean, I've seen Monty. Monty's putting his point of view to De Gingand. And I've seen De Gingand putting the point of view to Monty. And you know, tossing the ball about. But never to lose their heads and say, I'll have you bloody removed. And to me, that's when they're getting dangerous.
How in a situation like that, where there's a big imbalance of rank, how did this would De Gingand have to give more deference? I mean, or would they argue almost as equals when they were actually discussing a professional?
Well, De Gingand and Monty were professionals. They did argue because De Gingand was the man that made the bans. And Monty okayed them or scrapped them. And De Gingand would have to start again. And this is why I say they used to pass the ball from one to the other, both giving their points of view, and come to a compromise or agree that one or the other was right.
Would you be able to hear what was said? Because that's not particularly good security, is it?
No. You would only go in... You know, you might be taking a meal in while they're talking. Somebody's meal. You would give him his meal, and then you would retire. And you would go back, they may still be on the same subject, but there's a lot of ground being covered in that.
So you'd only hear the tip of the iceberg of what they were talking about. What facilities were offered for them?
For what?
For these senior officers. Besides somewhere to have a meal and a drink, was there anything else that your mess provided?
No, nothing else. There was a little area where there was tables and chairs where they could go for the drinks, and where they could go and sit and talk. And my two waiters, if there were any talking to be done, or I was informed that they were going to have a conference or something there, it would be our job to patrol around the marquee just in case anybody came to say what was going on or that. Other than that, there was nothing. I would imagine that if there was going to be anything, what we would call secret, it would be in the Monty's caravan or in the planning office caravan, where the same thing would happen. The staff of those two caravans would patrol to see that nobody could get within earshot.
Who was allowed in the VIP mess then? Was it all Monty's?
I was used by Monty and them, but you used to get people, Americans used to come to see Monty and Alexandra, Polish officers that was with the Polish divisions and after the First Army came into America, we often used to get planes popping over.
And at what level of seniority?
Oh, you used to get them down. Some of them were only captains, but they had a job and wanted to see Monty and talk.
So they couldn't just come in if they didn't have to see Monty?
Oh, no. Unless they were in a party, and that's what I was for, because I had 10 tents for accommodation for them. But I hadn't 10 tents for accommodation of the British officer. They were VIPs. So if anybody came to see Monty and Monty couldn't put him up, I had a tent there for him.
But you didn't provide a reading room or any...
Oh, no. There was no time up there. No time up there for reading rooms. There was no recreation at all.
How much better or worse was the food provided to these people than that the ordinary people would get?
Well, the only difference, you had a better cook than what the normal cook in the line was, and we could go and buy fresh vegetables or any exotic fruit that was knocking about, where the boys in the line would never get that.
So, but the meat, would that be just the same? That would be ration issue quality, would it? Or would it be a bit better?
You would get meat. You'll get the same meat issue. But you'll get somebody go out and shoot something and bring it in and toss it in for the officers or what.
So it was heavily supplemented?
Sometimes it was an odd donkey or something like that. I mean, we used to kill them for a bit of fresh meat rather than corned beef. You know, up the desert, the ordinary soldiers would live on bully beef, 2 tablets. One was cabbage. One was a vitamin, and then he would get another one for sweet. And rice pudding. Rice pudding used to pour out of your ears. You know. And you were on that diet for so long.
Is that what you had to eat as well?
No. The 5 of us. Yes, that's all we got. Unless somebody brought a bit of meat and we got our share. Because the coat used to make sure you got your share. He was a little Welshman.
So you sometimes serve donkey up?
Then, I've eaten donkey, I've eaten old mountain goat.
And that's what the officers would be eating as well?
Yes. The thing about the desert was you could always buy eggs. For I've yet to meet the man that ever... saw a chicken. You could buy eggs by the dozen, but you never saw a chicken. And at this particular time while I'm talking there about Benita, the Long Range Desert Group, we had heard about them, never met any. And what my little cook used to do with the tea, he used to dry it. and give it to the wogs for eggs. You know, you used to use it and then dry it. And I always remember while we were in Bonita, this wog came in. At least we thought he was a wog. This wog came in and walked around the camp and came to our little cookhouse and asked us if we had any shy. And this little Welsh lad said, "Ah, any Maudie, I've got a bag full. Have you got any eggs?" "Yes." So he said, produced a dozen eggs. And he says, "If that's dried tea, I'll shove these eggs down your throat one at a time." And he was a long-range desert group. And he'd been talking in Arabic all the time. And that was the first one I'd ever met. And he was a right so-and-so, I'll tell you.
Did you come into more contact with them? Well, you must have done if you got to know him.
I got to know him then, and I'd seen these wogs walking about this, you know, inside a camp, but I never knew who they were. And this is what they were, the long-range desert group. And after the First Army landed, when they were fighting, these long-range desert group were sent out into the desert round the German lines that we were chasing back towards the First Army. And the Americans captured them and put them all in the clink and wouldn't let them go. They wouldn't believe they were Englishmen. And I went with Monty right up to the collapse of the German and Italian army in the Middle East.
Were you resigned to the fact you were going to, you know, this job?
I was resigned to it by then after being in front of this medical board in Bonita. I was resigned to it then that rather than being stuck in some little officer's mess in Cairo or somewhere else, I would prefer to be on the road than stuck in one of those. And so when the desert campaign finished, I was recalled back to Cairo and had to answer for the broken plates and broken cups and everything that was missing, and told to stand by. And just went about the normal routine again. And then when the invasion of Sicily came, we packed our bags and proceeded to Sicily.
This is the whole of the Cairo HQ, or just...
No, just Monty's HQ, so rear HQ.
The VIP... HQ was reformed, so mm-hmm. to speak. Mm-hmm. So and back on the same job, only in Sicily.
Mm-hmm. And again, I run into the Durhams. And this particular day in question, we were on the Catania plains. Me and this major QM had a fair set to. He was going to take all the tents off me, and reason or none, he wasn't going to get them, supposing I shredded them. And I was in front of the company commander the next morning, and I explained to the company commander